Morning, everybody. Boker Tov. Thank you for coming. It's wonderful to be in the shul, Ma'alim Bakodesh. When I walked in this morning, I didn't quite understand what was going on. I thought we'd brought a whole new festive feel to the shir downstairs. Also confused me because I knew half the people in the room of the bris and didn't exactly know what was going on. But Baruch Hashem, we should always be moved aside for simchas. Hopefully we'll have a good share here. If I could just reiterate, people should be careful with the drink, if they have any. I got a special heta to have some cold water up here, but that's hopefully all that we have. I also have an announcement to make. I was given a very last minute dedication for the share, which I didn't even get a chance to print off. But I will be very happy to read to you if I can find it. This should remind me also to ask you please to turn off your phones. The sponsorship is by Linda and Harry Bruckner in memory of Linda's mother, Feige Bas Yold Svi HaKohen, Aleha Shalom, which are Vilma Hollander, whose Yold site is today. I don't know if the Bruckners are here. Are they here? Excellent. I didn't know everybody's names. So wonderful. Thank you very, very much. Yasha Koach Gadol, thank you for your sponsorship. We really appreciate it. It should be an aliyah from the neshama. We better learn some good Torah on that basis. If I could also announce in advance, please, I will be away for the following 2 weeks. But in my place next week, you will have another Ma'alim B'Kodesh because you will have Rabbi Königsberg, who is the Rav of the Shul here, who will be speaking to you in this slot next week and the week after. So I strongly encourage you to come along for that. And then 3 weeks from today, I will be back hopefully, and there will be a special morning of Limudim in preparation for Hanukkah. It's called a Yom Gevura Bayamim Hahem Basman Hazeh, and I'm just the warm-up act on that morning. You have Rabbi Wine speaking and other people speaking as well. It should be a very exciting morning. I'm looking forward to it very much. That's 3 weeks from today. Okay, now, today's shiur is a little bit different from normal, because what I'm doing with you this week, as promised, is I'm going through some of the issues that the Ethiopian Beta Israel encountered halachically when they came to Eretz Israel. Last week we looked at the background, we looked at the history, but as I said last week, the Beta Israel were a Torah observant community for centuries, if not millennia. But when they came to Eretz Israel, they found a halachic system which was, on the whole, completely foreign to them. They did not have a system of halakha. They had, obviously, a tradition that was passed down from family to family, from kes to kes. A lot of their tradition was in their kohanim, their kesim. We'll talk about that too. And many questions arose, and I've written some of these questions. Are they allowed to continue with their traditional practices in Israel, even though it goes against the halakha? Are they bound by the halakha? If they are allowed, how long are they permitted? Is it just the first generation? Should the second generation be actively conforming with the halachic system? Should there be any difference between Ethiopians who were born in Ethiopia and can connect with that system maybe more traditionally and people who were born here? Or it's like Ethiopia is just in the history for them. You know, my great-grandparents came from Lithuania. I suppose I'm Lithuanian in certain minhagim, but I don't really connect with entirely what was going on there. Are they bound by the Shulchan Aruch? We'll see soon. That's a question. Even if they're bound by halacha, why should they be getting the halacha from the Shulchan Aruch? They're not Ashkenazim and they're not Sephardim. Or are they? Did they take on, if you like, the halachic practices of Rav Avadi Yosef because of their connection with him? We talked a little bit about that last time. And if not from the Shulchan Aruch, where should they get the halacha from? What about the Rambam? Well, they're not Yemenites. The Yemenites very much connect with the Rambam for historical reasons. Or are they Yemenites? Maybe there is an ancient connection with the Taimani community. Maybe we should be going right back to the Babylonian Talmud. Even if we say, yes, you have to conform with halakha. Who said the halakha is Mishnah Brura? Or Rav Yosef's, Rav Avadi Yosef's Svarim and Shuvot? Maybe we should be going back to the Babylonian Talmud, and we'll talk a little bit about that. Okay, so let's just start with a little bit on the literature of the Beit Yisrael. They have no books other than the Orit. The Orit, which of course is connected with the word, the Aramaic word Orita, meaning the Torah. The Orit is actually not a Pentateuch, it's an Octateuch. Okay, so they have five books of Moses, of Bereshit, Shemot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, and Devarim, plus Yoshua and Shoftim and Ruth. Why Ruth? Well, we're used to connecting Ruth with the other Megillot. It comes later in the Tanakh with Esther and Echa, etc. But of course, Ruth, chronologically speaking, is part of Sefer Shoftim, or is connected with Sefer Shoftim. It's all happening at the time of Sefer Shoftim. So they have that as the Orit. But their Tanakh, which is much bigger, of course, than their Orit, their Tanakh includes not just the 24 books of the Tanakh that we have, but it also includes many more books. There are actually 68 books in their Tanakh, and they comprise not only the books of our Tanakh, but also many of the books that found their way into the Septuagint. Now, there's a lot of history here. The Septuagint was a translation, Targum Shivim, of the Torah into Greek. Now, there are many different accounts of how the Septuagint was produced. There's one in the Gemara. Philo has a different one. Josephus has a different approach to this. There are Midrashim. But the Septuagint includes many of the books that now the Christians called, or later academics called, the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha. The Apocrypha are books that didn't quite get into either the Old Testament or, as the Christians would have it, the New Testament. And there are many apocryphal books that found their way into the Beit Israel's tradition. For example, the book of Baruch, the book of the Maccabim, the book of Chanoch, the book of Tuvia, Tobit, the book of Yudit. And many of these books, by the way, are referenced by Chazal. Some of them. Ben Sira is referenced by Chazal, and Yehudit is referenced by the Ramban. But they also have from the Pseudepigrapha. The Pseudepigrapha are other books that were written around that period that, for various reasons, didn't get into the Apocrypha either. They're a collection of books. For example, the book of Jubilees, Sefer HaYovlim. And that's going to be very important for us today. I don't know how familiar you are with Sefer HaYovlim. I'm a little bit familiar, but not very. For many centuries, the only translation we had of the Book of Jubilees, which is a Second Temple book from the 2nd century BCE, the only translation we had was from Ge'ez, from the Ethiopian language, because they are the ones that protected and maintained these books. Not just them, but the Ethiopian church. Don't forget the Ethiopian church also uses the Septuagint, and they also use Ge'ez as their liturgical and canonical language. And therefore the church, which protected many of these books, were only protected by the Ethiopians. For years, they're in Ethiopic. So the Beit Yisrael also connect with Sefer Yoflim, and we'll see soon this has a real impact on their halachic approach to things like Shabbat, etc. Now, as I mentioned, they use this language, Ge'ez. Ge'ez is not a spoken language by the Ethiopian people. The Kesim, the priests, know it, they learn it, they read it, and then they translate it into Amharic and into other languages which the Ethiopians speak. But that itself means that a lot of the learning is restricted to the priests, because they are the ones that really have access to the books in the original, to all of their Tanakh that they have. But the most of the people are really going to the priests for that. There are legends that the Beit Yisrael had Hebrew books, but they none exist, none remain, and what they have is what I just described. They also have a smaller canon of what we would call Midrashic material. And we're going to quote from one of those called, I'm probably pronouncing this wrong, the Tezaza Sanbat, which talks mostly about Shabbat, and it's a kind of midrash where Shabbat and God and the Jewish people are talking to each other about Shabbat-oriented things, and there are 22 lines in there which we need to look at, which is there, if you like, Shabbat laws that they bring down as well. Okay, fine. So let's jump into it. There are two real places that I would suggest that you look for further reading. As I said, they don't have the Gemara, they don't have the Mishnah, they don't have the Gemara, they don't obviously have the Rishonim that happened, the Achronim since then, they were cut off. In many ways, the Ethiopian tradition is a living Geniza. It's like we discovered this repository of customs. Rav Yoel ben Nun is very interested. Rav Yoel ben Nun is a very interesting person generally, and he likes innovating in certain ways. He was my son's Masada Kiddushin, which was a whole experience in and of itself. Many of the Rosh Yeshiva in the room were watching with some consternation as Rav Yoel was innovating new minhagim at the wedding. That's a whole conversation in and of itself. But the Ethiopians are very much like a Geniza that emerged from an ancient time and just appeared. So we can see in some way ancient Judaism represented in their practices, which we maybe used to do to some degree, but then moved past as the Torah Shebaal Peh, as the oral law developed halacha. And there are two books which I recommend to you. One of them is this one. This book is called From Sinai to Ethiopia. It's by Rabbi Sharon Shalom, who I bumped into, I mentioned last week, in America and have connected with. This book is also in Hebrew. This is an English translation, a very good English translation of the book. He gives the history and the background to Ethiopian Jewry, and he also includes something called what he calls a Shulchan Ha'orit. The Orit is their law. The Shulchan Ha'orit is like the new Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch. Of the Ethiopians, and he says, look, it's not necessarily for everybody, but he's basically, for the first time, recorded the following. The Ethiopian practice, the halachic practice on those areas, and then his suggested compromise for the Ethiopian community when they come to Israel, which we're going to see some of those very interesting ones today. So that's one book. That book is actually available free on Safaria. If you ever use Safaria, Safaria is growing at an exponential rate, and they uploaded many books, and his book, obviously with permission, I'm sure, and his book is there, so you can just go onto Safaria, just put From Sinai to Ethiopia, you can read the whole book online. The other book which I recommend is a book called Or Ha'orita. And Orita in the book is written Orit, with the other letters spelling Orita, which is by Rav Muvrato Solomon, who is another Rav. Both of them came through Gush Etzion. He wrote a book about based on the Parsha, but bringing in lots of Ethiopian ideas. The two have very different approaches. And what I want to do with you today is I want to first of all read you what I've called the conformity approach, which is, I've extracted 6 or 7 pieces from Rav Muvrato Solomon's book, where he says that his approach is basically the Ethiopians have to toe the line. They have to come in, they have to keep halakha, they have to keep Jewish minhagim where possible, and they can keep their own minhagim only where they don't contradict the halakha. So basically they're like any other Jewish community that is banned by the halakha, with a few exceptions. Rabbi Shalom has a completely different approach, and you'll see some of the psakim he gives are very innovative, where he feels that the Ethiopians should continue their practice at least into the first generation when they come here. They can't be required to just, you know, turn on a dime, if you like, and go from being, you know, Jews who felt that they were keeping Torah for thousands of years potentially, and suddenly be placed in Israel and being asked to do things which, according to them, are completely prohibited. Completely prohibited. For example, having a Brit Milah on Shabbat, they say, is completely prohibited. Fasting on Shabbat is completely prohibited. It for them, carries the death penalty. Even when Yom Kippur falls on Shabbat, what are you going to do with that? And therefore, we're going to see some examples from Rabbi Shalom's book, and we'll see how that goes. But first, let's look together. Quite a lot of the sources are in English today because I brought them from this book. I didn't feel there was any point in us getting through them all in Hebrew. But I brought you Rav Solomon in Hebrew here. Have a look at number one. So he starts off by saying, let's be clear, he says, we have a very ancient tradition, says Rav Solomon, about the Ethiopians. Number one, Sefer Zeh, this is not the book here, but this is his book, Or Ha'orita. Sefer Zeh nichtav b'rosh u'b'rishona b'shvili u'b'shvil nishpati. I've written this book for my family. Chashavti shebederet zot nitan la'avir hala, we have to move onwards, et mesoret hanifla'a shel yahadut Ethiopia. This amazing tradition, he says. Yesh kol kach harbeh b'moreshet hayahadut ha'atika hazot. There's such an ancient, amazing tradition, let's not belittle it. Chelek miminageh meshakfim, that many of the minhagim, they throw light below safik without any question. Masorit atika shekadmah tekanot chazal. They give us a window onto what we as a Jewish community used to do before Chazal, if you like, developed rabbinic Judaism in the way that we know it today. The mishol zeh. This represents, therefore, for other communities, like I said, a living geniza from a past age. Many of the minhagim that I'm going to talk about in this book, you can find hints of them in the pre-Mishnaic books, the apocryphal books, the pseudepigraphal books. Even some ancient midrashim, and I would mention this as well. Sefer Hayovlim, the book of Jubilees, contains within it some of what we came later to call Midrashim. That we find in the Midrash, we find them 300, 400, 500 years earlier in the Sefer Yovlim. Meaning that the life did not start with the Midrashim. The Midrashim reflect older practices. And he says, you see this with the Ethiopians. Okay, many times we've forgotten this old picture from our collective conscience. And it looks to us that they're coming to us with a completely strange Masorah, which came from somewhere else, and that's not justifiable. Meaning, don't think that, oh, who are these Ethiopians? They've just picked up all this stuff from living on their own in 2,000 years in Ethiopia. Lo nachon. They represent an ancient, authentic Jewish Masorah. However, number two, Ein Safek, and again, he has this all in different places in the book. I've collected them all together for you. Ein Safek, there is, on the other hand, no question, Shebnei Kirat Yehudi Ethiopia Mitzvodidim Kayom Im Harbe Minagim Shonim Ushonim She'einu Shatim LeYadut Ethiopia. There is no question that they have developed, if you like, many minhagim which are not really relevant to Ethiopian Jews at all. Elishalitzarenu, to our great pain, hagalut hechricha et bnei hakila, the galut, the persecutions and the communities they lived in have forced them, if you like, kemogam bnei kilot acherot chayu begalut, like every other kila. You know, the Sephardim picked up Shtuyot from North Africa, and the Ashkenazim picked up stuff from Poland. And they also picked up stuff. Lisfag dvarim shelo shaychim lahem. And therefore the Ethiopians for sure are coming with things which do not reflect the ancient Jewish tradition. They reflect stuff they picked up in Africa. So how are we going to navigate that? Kayom be'Eretz Yisrael, and today he says, in Eretz Yisrael, mutelet ha'achrayut al hakilot la'asot ma'amatzim. We now have to, they have to make big, big efforts, la'hasir et kol Elohei ha'nicha'a mitocham, to get rid of all of the false gods. Kamo Yaakov Avinu b'shata, just like Yaakov Avinu did in his time, he's bringing here in the parsha when Yaakov tells his family in Vayeshev to put aside all the false gods. Ach gam litchazek b'masoret ha'tovot she'inchilu lanu avoteinu ha'tovim ha'tovim ha'kadoshim, and then to hang on to all the authentic stuff. I feel a little bit like he's a Gushnik speaking here as well, because he is a Gushnik as well, and he's saying like, you have to get rid of all the shtuyot, all of the stuff which is superstitious, etc. I mean, I grew up in a very Polish, Lithuanian, Ashkenazi home, all sorts of weird stuff. My parents did, my grandparents did, and they do this, and they touch this, and they threw this, and they never cut anything on me, and they made me wear my shirt backwards, and I have to wash this hand, and then a lot of the stuff was nonsense. A lot of the stuff was real. So he said, what we need to cut through here is to get to the real Masorah and throw away and jettison the stuff which is not real. Okay, good. Number three. Sorry, this is slightly smaller print, but this is a very important paragraph. And he says here, many of the minhagim that came later from the Jewish community, Kamar, Kagan, Hatapuach Badvash, Rosh Hashanah, apple and honey, some Gedalia. It's interesting, he puts apple and honey together with some Gedalia. You know, apple and honey is, comes like, where is it? Some Gedalia is in the Tanakh. Okay, fine. Apple and honey, some Gedalia. They didn't keep any of that. Mishum shelumu Torah be'Ethiopia ha'nachalatam she'al yechidei segula bilvat. And he makes an important point. The only people that really learned Torah, in the sense that they had it, even, were individuals. Yechidei segula, not the general population. V'gam heim landu ach v'rak et pashtei ha'ktuvim. And they really had no oral law. They only learned the written law. Hamon ha'am, the regular people, lo hursha lilmod mipnei kedushat ha'Torah. They didn't learn because they felt the Torah was too holy. Okay? Shelo kol echad yachol itasek ba. They had a very, I might say Catholic rather than Protestant, if you know what I mean, attitude, that the priests learn the Torah, they have the traditions, and we do what they say, and we shouldn't have maybe personal access to the scriptures ourselves. They didn't read them, they didn't speak gaze, they didn't read gaze, etc., etc. So he says that's a reality which is very different from ours, very culturally different. The rabbis introduced in Torah Sheba'al Peh, maybe even this was the case before, a very broad access to a democratization of Torah learning. Everybody should be learning Torah. Even when Rabban Gamliel, if you remember the Gemaras, was trying to keep the yeshivas more elite, that everyone who came to yeshiva had to be tocho kubaro, had to pass a certain bar of ethics and virtue, etc., etc. When they got rid of Rabban Gamliel, when they deposed him, the famous story there in Gemara and Brachas, they immediately opened the doors of the yeshiva. Everybody who wants to learn can learn. Ah, you're not such a big tzaddik. Okay, you'll become a bigger tzaddik through learning. So we have a very broad, we take it for granted that we have a broad access attitude to Torah, since they didn't have this. From some perspectives, is Torah Ethiopia nishara abemakom. The Torah in Ethiopia stayed where it was, but surat abasisit od mizman hamikra, and it didn't develop. It didn't move on from the time of Tanakh. Hatorah lo hitpatcha. It didn't develop in bechinat omek kavanat haTorah, and they didn't get into the depths, the kishkas of the Torah. V'nitzan lomar shekilat Yehudi Ethiopia lo hushpa'a mikviyot shela haTanah Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, and they certainly didn't have the revolution of Rabbi Yehuda Anasi who brought the Mishnah. He said the Hamishnah, and more importantly, the idea on which the Mishnah is based, which is the pasuk Eit la'asot la'Hashem heferu turatech. What is the justification for writing the oral law, developing the oral law, producing the whole system that the Mishnah and the Gemara produces and the way it produced it? It's the rabbis understood in Tehillim, Eik la'asot la'Hashem. We have to act for Hashem because otherwise the Torah will be lost. That itself is very radical. The Ethiopians just didn't have that. They had the Pasuk in Tehillim, but they didn't interpret it in that way. So the whole attitude of what we take for granted as being Judaism, they didn't have that at all. They were very, very conservative. Misiba zo, from this, and by the way, you can trace this perhaps even to the debates between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the Perushim and the Stukim were much more conservative, and they wouldn't interpret the Stukim, and they took much more literally what was going on. The Perushim, who became Chazal, were much more innovative, and Hillel and Shammai, there's a lot of history to talk there. They very much represented the Masorah from what was Shammai, and not the Stukim themselves, but that whole approach. Have a look here, second paragraph. And therefore, when we're trying to work out how to keep mitzvot, it's not possible for they didn't have that mesorah. Therefore, very many differences developed in minhag between us and them. Kiyum ha-mitzvot v'kol ha-olam ha-yehudi neva mitoch ha-mishnah, gemara, midrashim, ha-kabbalah, kudomah. We had all these influences for thousands of years. Shehayu zarim lanu be-Ethiopia. They were completely foreign to Ethiopia. B'nei ha-eida. And therefore, we, the rest of the Jewish people, shepakshu be-eretz surat chayim hilchatit shoneh, who come across, you know, this new way of, the Ethiopian way of doing things, we fill in all sorts of details that they never had. Because of their great detachment, their isolation. Although, however, they didn't have this familiarity, this depth of learning that we have. Emunatenu be'elokei Yisrael, our emunah, the Ethiopians' emunah, in the God of Israel, or Torah Moshe, okay, haitachat mashma'it, was absolutely clear, crystal clear. Yudei Ethiopia, masru et nasham vehikrivu et hayakar lahem. The Jews of Ethiopia were mosen nefesh. They sacrificed what was the most dear to them. They died. Kedei lidvok be'emunatam, to stick to their faith. Shmirat ha-mitzvot be-Ethiopia, the way they kept mitzvot ve-kiyuman halacha la-maasa kefi havelatam sham, the way they kept halacha, etc., their own practice. How mitzvot kavanat tahora la-kayelik mitzvot ha-Torah, they really wanted to do it right, etc. Ba-aretz nivgashnu et derech shoneh. And now in Israel we've seen a different way, ve-kiyum ha-mitzvot mi-knei shilimot ha-Torah kan shalach. So he says, you shouldn't for one second think that the Ethiopians haven't given their very lives to keep this Torah. They shouldn't be critiqued in any way for not having developed it. But at the end of the day, what are we going to do? Fact. And now you'll see his approach in halacha. Number four. Leonid Danti. My approach is as follows. Now, which halacha is he dealing with here? On the festival of Sigd, which they celebrate on the 29th of Cheshvan. And usually on the afternoon, it's Erev Rosh Chodesh. So no one says Tachanun. I mean, they didn't really have Tachanun anyway, but none of us say Tachanun because it's Erev Rosh Chodesh. When Sigd falls on Shabbat, they bring Sigd forward to the Rabbanut, said bring it forward to Thursday. So they bring it forward to Thursday. Okay, so it's Thursday. So should, when they daven Mincha on Sigd, should they say Tachanun? Very technical question. So look at what's look number four. Leania Daiti. It seems to me, whenever it comes to the minhagim of the Ethiopian people, ima minhag soter et halacha, if the minhag contradicts our halacha, yesh lachri linhag al pi halacha. You have to follow the halacha. The minhag has to go. Lahoitzi mikrim charugim, except for very unusual cases. For mikreze, in this particular case, of Yashal Yom Sigd Barova Muchlat Hu Yom Tfila. So he says, what is Sigd? Sigd is not just one big party. They eat afterwards a lot, but it's a day of Tfila, it's a day of Tachanunim. Eino Mugda Kachag. It's not really a Chag. He says, in the way that you think of, Simchas Torah is a Chag. Al Kein Yeshla Maba Tachanun. And therefore, you have to say Tachanun. Now, I found this remarkable. In Judaism more broadly, especially with the Hasidim, every single excuse they have to drop Tachanun, Tachanun is the first thing that goes. You know, I've been to airports so many times, you'd have them in Mincha, in JFK, coming back to Israel, and it's always the Hasidim that make them in. You never say Tachanun. I was like, why today? What's going on? Why are we not saying Tachanun? There's always this and there's always that. Once one guy said to me, we're all happy, we're getting on a plane going back to Eretz Israel, we're not going to say Tachanun. Now, again, Rav Solomon is a brisker. He's a Litvak Ethiopian. He's coming out of the Beis HaMedrash in Gush, and he's saying, no, I'm sorry, you've got to say Tachanun. Even Tachanun you can't drop. Everybody else drops Tachanun. No, even Tachanun, he really applies it all the way through. What about their tefillah? Number six, the Ethiopians have a completely different way of davening tefillah. They didn't have the same structure of tefillah that we have in the rest of the Jewish world. Kivan shechazal sidru lanu nusach kavua letefillah. Now we have a clear nusach for tefillah. Kedei shelo kol echad me'am Yisrael tiyeh avsheut leitpalel b'tzura sidura b'lashon sacha. And they do that because not everybody knows how to daven. Chazal have given us shachris, mincha, marid, minyan, fixed prayers, shemona esrei. Kach tzarech liyot gam b'legabi edotenu hakadosha. So the Ethiopians have to fall in line. What about their traditional prayers? What about the things they've been saying for thousands of years, or at least hundreds of years? He says, Yachadim zeh, minag avoseinu biyadim. But we can't get rid of our minagim completely. Tamid eshala hosif tfilah spontanit. The Ethiopians can, of course, work in tfilah spontanit, their own spontaneous tfilah, ishit, personal tfilah. Come on, Ethiopia, looks like they did in Ethiopia. Al pi haklal hamlatzot, shel rabotein. Meaning, whenever we're allowed, and not only allowed, but encouraged, and we don't always do this, to put our own private, spontaneous prayer in, he said, of course they can, and they should. But where must Minhag Ethiopia fit? Within the Gidarim of Halakha. If the Halakha allows you to say a spontaneous prayer, okay, you can say your Ethiopian Minhagim. Our Ethiopian Minhagim is Ethiopian. But if it doesn't, no. I'm sorry. So again, he's allowing the minhag, but only in very strict guidelines, where it can actually fit in with a very clear halachic practice with almost no compromises. Number six. This is our last quote from Rav Solomon. He is a product of Gush Etzion, but he's a product of Rav Shlomo Levi. Rav Shlomo Levi, you may or may not know, he was my son's Rosh Kolel. My son went through the Kolel in Har Etzion, and he is a brilliant, brilliant halachist. He's the son-in-law of Rav Chaim David Levi from the Chief Rabbi in Tel Aviv. I think it's coincidental they have the same name. But he's a very down-the-line, halachically conservative little C poisek. The Gush sometimes has this name for being, whoa, Gush Etzion, like, yeah, anything goes. They do all these innovative things. Yes, very much in Tanakh, but not so much in Halacha, leaving Rav Yoel aside for now. Okay, I remember one particular expression of this. I've mentioned this before. Actually, I'll tell you exactly where it was. Many years ago, when Barack Obama was coming to the end of his tenure, and there was this whole question as to there were resolutions coming up in the United Nations Security Council that they were trying to get in quickly before Donald Trump took over, very, very similar to the times we live in now. And there was a whole question, are they going to pass a bad one, a worse one, a better one, etc., etc. And there was a really bad one planned. In the end, there was a not-so-great one passed anyway, but they were going to do something worse. And it was vetoed, not by the Americans, I think the Egyptians pulled it, or something like that, I don't remember exactly. And Rav Yoel Ben Nun was so excited, Rav Rimon was away that Shabbos, he'd asked Rav Yoel Ben Nun to give the drasha. He stood up on stage and he said, "This is such good news for the Jews, even if it could all go wrong again next week," which to some degree it did. He said, "I have to make a bracha with Shem Umalchus." He says, "I'm going to stand up and I'm going to say Hatov V'Hametiv B'Shem Umalchus." And he stood up on there in front of the shul. He said, "Baruch Atah." And he said, "Shem Hashem," this bracha. And Rav Moshe Lichtenstein couldn't contain himself. He was sitting there listening. He went, "No!" Like this. Like, it was unbelievable. And then everyone... And you had this battle of the titans, and afterwards they were very good-natured, talked it through. So I'm just sharing that with you. It was a very remarkable situation. So you have coming out of the Gush different ideas. And Shlomo Levi, the Rosh Kollel, was relatively, conservative. Look at number six. Kayom nitan lomar she'rov b'nei ha'eda mudaim. Now almost everybody in the Ethiopian world is well-informed. Le'isul shel negiya ben bachur lebachara. What's he talking about here? The Ethiopians had a practice when they used to greet each other, men and women, they used to shake hands and they used to kiss on the cheek. Now they had very clear guidelines of tzniut in a very natural sense. They were very dignified and very modest people. And this was considered a completely non-event. Everyone just kiss on the cheek and shake of the hand, squeeze of the hand. He said, now everybody knows the halacha. Even though the Ethiopian Jews find it very difficult to pull away from this minhag, we have to do everything we can. This minhag was great back in Ethiopia. Now things are different. Israel is a very different place. Israel is a land which is exposed to Western pritzut. It's not like it was in Ethiopia. Things are different here. If you want to shake hands when you say hello, v'nishuk al alechi, and to kiss on the cheek, shenaagnu b'Ethiopia, ka'asher adava haya tachat ha'roshem ha'gedol shel hergelet tzniut she'enhigu sham. This was part of a much bigger tzniut that they kept very carefully there. Loi haita klal konotatsia shel chiba otava. That shake of the hand, that kiss on the cheek, had no connotation of anything sexual at all. Ava. Kayom, but today, ba'avira hashogeret ba'eretz Yisrael. In the very different atmosphere we're in Israel, with the internet and everything, in kol amida, v'tikshoret, in all of the media exposure, hari amira kazo yichola barov mifrim leiparesh nedavka l'chiba v'talba. Now people will explain a kiss on the cheek as something which is potentially sexual. I mean, you could argue with this, even in today's world, as to whether a kiss on the cheek is necessarily or not necessarily sexual. That's a different question I'm not getting into now. Certainly you could argue a handshake, and there are many gedolim, v'tovim, and major poskim that will absolutely insist that a full man will shake a hand of a woman, certainly when she puts her hand out, leaving that aside. And therefore he says, b'mana shelati b'inyan zeh, hashiveni morei b'rabbi Rav Shlomo Levi. So Rav Shlomo told me on this issue, ki achen yesh li'izam l'voma magi kosher hui mishad, the Ethiopians are not allowed to touch people even now. Together with that, and then he says, if it's going to be, it's going to be insulted, maybe it's different. But if he's just bringing in the regular halakha here, especially he says with elderly people, where there's clearly no connotation of anything sexual, so, but he's bringing in heterim that anyway apply to everybody when it comes to these issues. But in principle, he says, they absolutely need to keep the halakha. And the kiss on the cheek, which the Ethiopians will see soon from Rosh Shalom, the Ethiopians were very upset when they said, you can't do that. They said, why are you telling us that? You're accusing us of inappropriate behavior? How dare you? We've been doing this for millennia. No one ever had we have better tzniut than you could ever dream of. And now we can't give each other a kiss on the cheek. Rosh Shalom says, no, you can. He disagrees completely with this approach and says for the Ethiopians it's okay. So we'll see in a minute how that works. So what we've seen so far is a very interesting approach by Rav Solomon, which is very conservative, little scene. Follow the halakha, keep your minhagim only where they fit completely into the halakha system. Now, let's turn to Rav Shalom. Rav Shalom writes an introduction where he sets out his 13 rules for how he's going to apply Ethiopian halakha. Let's have a look at these quickly. And the rest of the shi will largely be English, but let's have a look at this here.
Source number 7 on page 4. He says, Shulchan Aruch was written out of a personal need, a way to serve God. Thus, the reader should not consider this work as intended for the public. Okay? You know, that's what all authors say. I'm sure he wants people to read it, but he's a very humble person. I know him personally. Still, some may find it useful for paving personal paths within their respective spiritual worlds. The goal of this work is to collect the customs of the Beit Yisrael community and to preserve customs that were transmitted orally. 3. This book presents a halachic method that returns the crown of glory to ancient glory for Ethiopian Jews. So that's already a big departure. He sees this work as going back, restoring the Ethiopian minhag to its rightful place. It does not intend to negate other methods, meaning I'm not going to argue with Rabbi Solomon if he wants to do that, then that's, they know each other, obviously. 4. To show the connection between different customs, I give the Talmudic halacha alongside the Ethiopian customs. It's a very good summary, actually, of halacha, our halacha. Number 5. Ethiopian Jewish customs are very ancient, apparently preceding the Talmudic era. Thus, Torah scholars can use them to study Talmudic issues. Now, that's interesting. Using the Ethiopian lens to understand better ancient Judaism and the rabbinic Judaism then. Number 6. Preservation of these customs is a value, while keeping them is an emotional need. Therefore, we should not feel obligated to keep customs in any situation. Sometimes we do have to drop things. 7. This work intends to remove barriers and promote friendship, not to create obstacles. Therefore, in case of conflict, unity precedes other considerations. Now, that's interesting. Using a sort of meta-halachic, Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, says where one of the major factors is going to be, is my psak going to create this unity? 8. In this work, educational and social concerns are factors in a halachic decision of whether to keep a custom or annul it. 9. A custom that creates conflict between a married couple should be annulled. We'll talk about that soon. Number 10. If a custom creates a conflict among members of the Ethiopian community and there's no solution other than to annul it, then the unity of the community takes precedence and the custom should be annulled. Number 11. The first generation of Ethiopian Jews in Israel will continue to practice their customs without consideration for other issues. That's a very interesting comment. That means you're going to have Ethiopian Jews eating chicken in a cream sauce in the privacy of their own home. First generation. Okay? We must demonstrate maximum understanding towards these customs. The second generation should be permitted to continue their ancestral customs, but with other considerations applying. Number 12. Some customs that were practiced in Ethiopia should be ceased completely, even amongst first generation Ethiopian immigrants. Among these are certain Ethiopian customs to give precedence to keeping mitzvot over saving a life. We'll see the Egyptians gave precedence to mitzvot, the Ethiopians gave precedence to mitzvot over, in any situation, over life. No, the other way around. No, yes, that way around. Sorry, getting confused. Keep the mitzvah even if you're going to die. Because if you're going to die, that's what Hashem wants. Hashem wants you to do the mitzvah, and if that, God forbid, results in a death, that's very tragic, that's very unfortunate, but the mitzvah takes priority. He says that has to be dropped, because of v'chai v'hem, we have to, even though that's a rabbinic understanding. And lastly, the Talmud, not the Shulchan Aruch, takes precedence as a halachic guide for Ethiopian Jewry. Which actually, very interestingly, is a throwback to the Ashkenazim, strange as it seems. When the Shulchan Aruch was introduced, largely, the popular reception of the Shulchan Aruch was largely the Sephardim. The Sephardim saw it, because it was primarily a Sephardim work. Rav Yosef Karo is the vast majority of the Shulchan Aruch, and of course the Bet Yosef that came before it. This idea of drawing a line on the previous halacha and moving forward with a new system, based on his halachic psak, according to the majority of the Rif, the Rambam, and the Rosh, the Sephardim really kind of bought into this. The Ashkenazim were very unhappy, many of them. If you look at the Maharshal, you look at the Maharal, if you look at the Bach, they're very unhappy with the Shulchan Aruch as an innovation. They say the way that we work in halacha as Ashkenazim is we go back to the Talmud. You master the whole Talmud. You work out from the immense complexity of the Talmud what the halacha should be. And if you can't do that, you ask someone who can. And that becomes the halacha. And you don't just look it up in a book. Putting everything in a book is going to crystallize halacha, it's going to freeze it, it's not going to allow it the kind of innovation. So, interestingly, Rav Shalom is suggesting for the Ethiopians what the original Ashkenazim, after the Shulchan Aruch, wanted to do all along. I don't know if he's doing that consciously. In the end, who won? The Shulchan Aruch or the Ashkenazim? I actually think the Ashkenazim won. No, the Ramah was not, according to those people I mentioned, the Ramah was part of the problem, not part of the solution. He made it a little bit better, but what did the Ashkenazim do to the Shulchan Aruch? They turned it back into the Talmud. I mean, the original Shulchan Aruch was meant to be just a little handbook. It was in your pocket. You review it every 30 days and you do what it says. Now you open a Shulchan Aruch and it's got 25 commentaries all around it. Almost every single one Ashkenazi. That's how they wreaked their revenge on the Shulchan Aruch. They accepted it, but turned it back into a work of limud. That's how they won in the end. It's actually very, very interesting how they did that. And it's a peculiarly Ashkenazi thing. Okay, let's get into some of these mitzvot. Shabbat. So, as I mentioned to you, one of the few written texts that the Ethiopian Jews had as a halachic, let's call it, text, is these 22 lines from the Tezah Sambat, which talks to the Midrash about Shabbat. Let's read it together, number 8. These are the commandments of the Sabbath that I wrote for thee, and all the laws and prescriptions of the Sabbath. Now, this is not from the Torah, this is from their text. 6 days shalt thou labor, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord. Now, all of you recognize this, this is from the Ten Commandments. In it you shall do no work, neither you, nor your women, nor your sons, nor your daughters, nor your menservants, nor your maidservants, nor your cattle, nor your family, nor the strangers that are with you. He who labors in it shall die. So far, no big surprises. That's basically what the Torah says. 2, he who profanes this day shall die. Okay, that's breaking Shabbat. Could I ask you just to turn off the phone, please? Thank you very much. Whoever can find it and turn it off. Okay, well, I'm sure it'll get there. Okay, number 3. He who lies with his wife on the Sabbath shall die. What are we going to do about that? He who argues or speaks aloud or seeks a quarrel, he who buys or sells on that day shall die. Meaning there's no rabbinic level here. There's no, it's usser, but it's potter, aval usser, or not. It's either allowed or it's death. That's how it works. Again, maybe what was more the case in the kind of pre-rabbinic interpretation age. He 5, he who draws water from a streaming spring or who argues or curses or blasphemes on that day shall die. You have to watch how you talk on Shabbos. And again, many of these ideas came into halakha. Of course, we have to speak differently on Shabbat, but it's not chayv misa for them, it is. He who prepares not what he will eat, drink, or give on the Sabbath, who lies, shall die. Number 7, he who carries anything, who takes something from his tent or brings something into it, shall die. 8, thou shalt do no work whatsoever on the Sabbath, but use that which you prepared on Friday. Sabbath is the day on which to eat, to drink, to be satiated, to be filled with drink, to rest, to study, to lie down, to be quiet, to celebrate, and to worship without doing any work. 9, he who works on my Sabbath, travels or goes on a journey, does any work in his field or in his house, kindles the fire, sits in the sun, shall die. If he doesn't die from sitting in the sun already, I suspect. Number 10, he who rides on any beast or travels in a boat, he who strikes or kills or fornicates, shall die. Now just for a second, there's a very interesting Gemara where the Sanhedrin took a man who was riding a horse on Shabbat and they gave him the death penalty. And the Gemara has a whole analysis. How could that be? It's a drabbanon, and da-da-da-da. And they come up with it. Well, they had to make a point for a very specific situation, and they had to do that. It's not normal. Well, here you see, actually, there was a whole stream of thought that if you ride on a horse, that is a death penalty event. Was that part of it as well? That's an interesting example, maybe, of using the Ethiopian practice to relearn where the Talmud was coming from. 10, we just didn't have 11. He who fasts on the Sabbath shall die. 12, he who does any manner of work on my Sabbath shall die. Thus shall the children of Israel be holy and celebrate the Sabbath according to the commandments as they are written on the 2 tables, which are tablets, which God gave to me that I might write down the law for thee from now on and throughout all generations. And the Sabbath says to God, a little bit more midrashic, I was with thee when thou created the heaven. O Lord, give me thy consent and send me not, meaning, I don't want, says the Shabbos, the following people on my Shabbos. The unjust, the slanderous, the quarrelsome, the treacherous. Drive me not away towards those who strike me with their spittle, can't spit, who sit in the sun, who wash not with water, you didn't go to the mikveh before Shabbos, who lie with women, who purify not their manners, who cover not their, it's not clear what that word should be, who throw away their spittle, quench not their fire, meaning you've got to put your fire out on Friday. You can't have your candles or your fire burning on Shabbos and accept not my commandments. As to the women, here's the complaint. They knead their dough, they cook, they draw water, they crush in the mortar, they shout, they neglect my commandments, and they rebuke their neighbors. Interesting. All things which are not allowed on Shabbat. Some of these, of course, are malachot, cooking and crushing, which is interesting as well. So what are we going to do? By the way, this comes very clearly from the Book of Jubilees. I brought you in the footnote in number 7, the wording at the end of the Book of Jubilees, which this seems very much to be connected with. So let's look at some halachic issues. Shabbos candles. The Ethiopians didn't have Shabbos candles, obviously.
they put them out because they can't have fires burning. They didn't light them. It's not that they put them out, they put all fires out. What should they do now? Should they light candles? Number 9, Rabbi Shalom. Lighting Shabbos candles has become a very special mitzvah for the Jewish people, one that is much loved by those who perform it. The candles bring calm and peace to the home, create a special spiritual atmosphere, and lead to family togetherness. Lighting candles is a clear sign of a Jewish home. Thus, Ethiopian Jews who find it very difficult to light candles may continue the custom of not lighting, but those who understand that this practice has special import, particularly to the younger generation, should light, especially since the lighting takes place before Shabbat begins. Okay? So basically, what does he say? Try light candles. If you really can't, then you can't. What about hot food? The Ethiopians had no hot food on Shabbat. The halakha is very concerned about this, because this was a Karaite custom. And we have all sorts of minhagim that we've innovated in order to have hot food on Shabbat. Cholent, no one's quite sure where cholent comes from, but it may come from the two French words chaud and lent, which is hot and slow, which makes sense. A way that you can have halakhically permissible hot food on Shabbat. We now have urns and we have platters and we have all sorts of timers and this and that and the other. But the Ethiopians didn't want anything of that. They actually considered it to be totally prohibited. And when the Kesin came, Rav Sharon says, when the Kesin came and they saw these hot plates coming on Shabbos, on timers, they were astounded that the Jews didn't know how to keep Shabbos. Number 10. One who considers use of the electric hot plate or one of the source of heat as a violation of Shabbos, as was the case in Ethiopia, may continue to follow the ancestral custom. This should not be considered a Karaite practice, meaning let it be cold on Shabbos. It looks like you're a Karaite. No, since their motivations are different, as the Radvaz wrote, we saw last week, they're not Karaites. In any case, the Ethiopian Jews consider use of a hot plate like use of a real fire. In the world of Ethiopian Jewry, what counts is the end result and not the method of warming. Well, for the sages, debate on this issue focuses on the manner of warming the food. Don't forget, our Gemara is very conceptual, very abstract. It's not just that they didn't have the details of the Gemara, they didn't have the methodology of the Gemara. We turn halacha into a very conceptualized area. It's not the result, it's the method, etc. They don't have any, they just don't think that way. It's heating. Still, the second generation of Ethiopian Jews who have become accustomed to reality in Israel will consider eating cold food to be detrimental to the enjoyment of Shabbat, and therefore they can warm things up, and they're not called violating their Ethiopian minhag. Okay, good. Wine. The Ethiopian Jews associated wine with Avodah Zarah and the church, and they were most nefesh to keep themselves apart from the church. And obviously they didn't produce wine there in Africa. It wasn't a grape harvest location. And they said wine bore evil spirits. They said anyone who drinks wine is an idol worshipper. So should they make kiddush on wine? Number 11, says Rabbi Shalom, the first generation of Ethiopian Jews who denigrate wine as a symbol of Avodah Zarah are not required to say the blessing of wine on Shabbat, but the second generation has undergone a transformation and they can use wine. Fine. If they want to continue to say the blessing on bread, they can do so. Don't forget, you can make hamotzi on bread. You can make kiddush, on bread. Certainly on Friday night, you can make kiddush on bread. So, you want to make kiddush on bread? Make kiddush on bread. And then you avoid the problem. Shabbos morning, you don't even have to have wine. You could have a chama medina, you could have another drink, you could have a cup of tea, a cup of coffee if you really want to. So there are other opportunities to do kiddush, and therefore he tries to make this pshara. But what are we going to do about marital relations on Shabbat? That the Ethiopians were horrified by and considered to be a death penalty event. How are we going to do that? Look at number 12. Says Rav Shalom. Because the prohibition is mentioned in the Book of Jubilees, an early work, and its source is an ancient custom practiced amongst Jewish groups in the sages' times, I would like to propose a new reason for specifying that Torah scholars should have relations on Shabbat. Basically, he then says that he thinks that Chazal said that Shabbat is a good time to have for a husband and wife to have sexual relations in order to go against heterodox groups like the Sadducim, etc., that were fighting them on many other areas. In summary, second paragraph, we may say the strict observance of the laws of purity, which led the Beit Yisrael to prohibit this practice, was followed by certain sects during the Second Temple time. Thus, we should not disparage Ethiopian Jews who today continue to refrain from relations on Shabbat. What was their problem? The problem was Tumah. They kept the laws of Tumah and Tara very carefully. And a couple who engages in sexual relations become Tameh. Now for us, we are used to being Tameh. We're all Tameh all of the time. We don't go to the Beis HaMikdash. We don't bring korbanos. We don't eat kachin.
We'd manage perfectly well being tameh. So there's no nafkah in it. There's no practical difference if a couple become more tameh or less tameh. They were very, very careful. They were running to the river all the time to go to the mikveh. Every time they had an interaction with a non-Jew, they went to the mikveh. And therefore, you're going to tell me on Shabbos, the most holy day of the year, holier than Yom Kippur, we're going to make us become tameh? That's an outrage. And therefore he says, okay, so you know something, you don't have to have relations. The sages' opposition should be understood in the light of the story against the Karaites, but today is not a heretical custom. So we should permit those who wish to prefer their ancestral customs. And he says, on the other hand, those who say they don't want to keep them, they do want to follow the rabbinic approach on this, that's okay as well. But that's very, very interesting. In a minute we'll get to an even more stressed issue, which is the issue of Nida. And what they did and how they're going to do it now that they're in Israel. Over the page 7. According to the traditional Ethiopian practice, Shabbat could not be broken to save a life. No mitzvah could be broken to save a life. Okay, even a Brit Milah, if the baby was not well, no, the Brit Milah has to be done on the 8th day, unless it's Shabbat. So it's actually everything opposite. A Brit Milah could not be done on Shabbat for them. It had to be delayed, whereas we do it on Shabbat. But a Brit Milah on an unwell child had to be done, because if God wants the child to live, the child will live. What do we do about this? In Halakha, if you do that, it's tantamount to murder. You know, even asked a Shaila on Shabbat, should I break Shabbat to save this person's life? It's as if they murdered them. They should just save it. Act now and ask a Shaila later, if time is of the essence. So look at what Rav Shalom says. Number 13. Although the Ethiopian custom is based on an ancient method, the sages' writing on the value of life have penetrated the depths of Jewish consciousness. Very interesting. Here he says, well, Jewish consciousness says you can't do this. This is absolutely forbidden to continue to follow the Ethiopian custom, and the Beit Israel must immediately adopt the general Jewish custom for all issues of saving life. I think that's very interesting. Because, like, why? He could say, look, you know, why is their consciousness of who lives and who dies necessarily any different from our consciousness? But he says, no, that's an issue on which there has to be a change. We're not going to be sympathetic or tolerant of Ethiopian minhagim. However, on other issues, we are. They carried money on Shabbat. They used to give tzedakah on Shabbos. They used to, you know, give money on Shabbos. I mean, that occasionally happens. We had a situation in London where some American gviri came and they gave him an aliyah and he wasn't observant. And the gabba asked him, would you like to make a donation to the shul? So he says, fine, he rips a checkbook out of his pen on Shabbos. You know, in the shul says, how much shall I write? He says, no, not quite now. So the Ethiopians carried money to shul. They didn't have muksa. Muksa is a rabbinic construction. So he says, number 14, in various locations in Israel, in synagogues of the Ethiopian community, the congregants bring cash to the synagogue. Those who want to follow the custom of bringing should continue to bring. So if you go to an Ethiopian shul, maybe people will have the cash. As the money is designated for use on Shabbos, in the Ethiopian world, which is based on trust, we do not suspect that a person might use this money for other purposes on Shabbos. We believe that the individual wishes to serve God, and one who did not want to do so would not attend synagogue. In our world, suspicion is a foreign word. That's also interesting. The Chazal created a whole raft of halacha for people who would look at other people and suspect them. You can't do this even though you're not doing anything wrong because it's chashad, or people are going, we're very judgy. He says, the Ethiopians just didn't have that. Nobody looked at somebody else. If they had cash, nobody even thought that they'd be buying something. If they were going to buy something, they wouldn't be in the community because they wouldn't be part of it. Very interesting, very pure Tamimistic religion, he says. So let them bring the cash. And for some reason, umbrellas were very important. I imagine the sun was part of it. But the Ethiopian Jews, particularly the Kesem, walk around carrying umbrellas all the time. And he said, therefore, they can carry an umbrella on Shabbos. And if it's raining, then, you know, it also rains in Ethiopia, by the way. Maybe the umbrellas were for the rain. And therefore, he says, Ethiopians can carry umbrellas on Shabbos, even though other people don't. It's not entirely clear, by the way, why we can't carry umbrellas on Shabbos if we open them before Shabbos. And that's a whole shiur that I gave about umbrellas on Shabbos. But he says they don't need to worry about it. So if you see an Ethiopian in the street with an umbrella on Shabbos, then don't be surprised. Mezuzahs. They didn't keep mezuzah. No one knows why. Maybe they didn't have houses that they felt were, you know, warranted a mezuzah. They had constructions, obviously. Now he said they have to keep mezuzah. We're not sure why they didn't keep it then. Tefillin, they didn't wear tefillin. Seems to have got lost. Although he says his grandfather wore a kind of sort of amulet with black straps, which is very interesting. In fact, the word phylactery
in English means more like an amulet or a talisman of some kind. So he said, no, the Ethiopians should now wear proper tefillin, or at least those ones that they used to wear in Ethiopia, which of course are not kosher.
3,000 years and no Chabad Lubavitcher.
Ah, yeah, there's no Chabad house at Addis Ababa, but there probably is now. There probably is now. So you can read about that. Let's look into Nida and family purity. Page 8. The Beta Yisrael were very observant of Tumah and Tara. And basically, this applied not just to menstruation, but to childbirth, sexual relations, like I said before, contact with non-Jews, contact with non-kosher food. They considered, made them tamei, contact with the dead, obviously. And therefore, a woman was considered to be impure if she menstruated for 7 days. That's the law of Nida in the Torah. And if she had a baby, 40 days for a boy, 80 days for a girl. So what did they do? All Jewish villages in Ethiopia had a hut, which they called the house of blood, or the hut of the curse. That the women, when they were menstruating or when they were tamei after having given birth, they would go down, and the only people allowed there were women and nursing babies, because obviously there were a lot of women in these places with newborn children. I was thinking as I wrote this, how did anybody sleep when the entire place was full of screaming babies, you know, all in one place? I'm sure they just managed and they did just fine. But the women went down there. Family would bring food, gifts, stand outside. There was a stone wall between the rest of the village and this fence. Husband and wife separated for 7 days. At the end of the 7th day, after menstruation, the wife went to immerse in the river and purify herself and then came home. They didn't have any of the 7 clean days, which we have today. Today our Nida is a combination of Nida and Zava, where a woman gets a hefsek tara, stops bleeding, she keeps 7 clean days. They didn't have that. That's in the Gemara. And therefore, what should they do now? And of course, don't forget, when the Ethiopians came and people said to them, well, if your wife is Nida, just separate the beds, that's fine, was horrendous to them. Are you serious? How can we gonna share the same bedroom? Not even like move bedrooms? What about going to a move out of the house? Go to someone else's house? And therefore he says, number 18, says Rav Shalom, the women of the Ethiopian community should continue to immerse themselves on the 7th day after sunset, which is not when women go to the mikveh today. They get a hefsek tara and they wait another 7 days. 7 clean days. In the final analysis, this is the biblical commandment, and the community didn't take on the Talmudic stringency. The second generation may adopt it. The goal of marital harmony and national unity has a great value which supersedes other values. That's very interesting. These women are keeping, therefore, what you might call nida de oraita, which was 7 days. And this has become a whole discussion. Is that ever a legitimate option for anyone else? Of which the rabbis are very clear, the answer is no, but the Ethiopian community, and Rav Solomon I'm sure would say no, but the Rav Sharon says yes. As far as the Nida hut is concerned, he says the Beit Yisrael may continue to follow the ancient custom. However, they should realize that the reality in Israel is different from the reality they enable the practice of this custom. Today, it's almost impossible for a mother of a family to leave the home for an extended period. Therefore, it's preferable not to remove the woman from the home for educational or familial reasons. As an alternative, we may propose sleeping in separate beds, and in this manner, the custom is preserved while the family unity is unharmed. If the family, educational system, and marital harmony permits, we may even propose sleeping in separate rooms. The Ethiopian Jews are permitted to follow their custom, and this is not problematic. Okay, very interesting. You have to find a bashara, you have to find a way through. Also, what about mikveh? They didn't accept mikveh. They said that the nida has to go to mikveh, to toivel, I should say, in flowing water. In mayim chayim. So they're going to turn around to our mikvehs in Israel and say, not kosher. We're not going to do that. We're going to go to the sea. Now they can go to the sea, it's not so straightforward, so they go to the mikveh in the sea, logistically and halakhically. But what should they do? And he says they should basically be educated to try and follow mikveh as we know it today. In fact, the opposite, today to go to mikveh in a river, in a flowing river, could actually be a problem halakhically. But he wants them to fall in line with mikveh, and he said actually it's a problem because there are Ethiopians who won't use the mikveh and therefore don't use anything. And it's turning into a worse problem because they're not going to the mikveh at all because they don't like the setup of the mikveh. They're not used to it. And he says, therefore, they need to fall in line. I brought you number 9, a little bit about Mila, page 9 rather. Bris Mila on Shabbos we talked about. A woman mile. Very interesting. The Ethiopians, only the women did Bris Mila. So what happens if they want a woman mohelet, if that's the word? He says, fine, gesundheit. They should have a woman mohelet if they can find someone who's qualified. Meaning, Tzipora was a mohelet. and a woman, although Sipporim is a Midianite, which might make it a little bit different, not for now, but he said if they can find a lady who's qualified, then no problem at all. Coming of age, he said the Ethiopian coming of age was age 7. And they made the kids fast on Yom Kippur from 7. He says they should follow the general practice today and make it 12 or 13. Just very quickly, just the last couple of things I'll mention to you. The kissing and shaking hands, he's very unhappy with the approach we read before. He said, no, it's not a problem. If they want to continue to do that, they should be allowed to do that. It's honestly not sexual at all. Kashrus is very interesting. They didn't have kashrus of meat the way we do. They didn't salt it and soak it. They used to cut it into little pieces, wash it and hang it up to dry. Now, that's just trade, as far as we're concerned. Can they continue with that? So you'll read what he puts in 25. He actually says some people can, which is very interesting. Meat and milk. They didn't wait between meat and milk. Why would they wait between meat and milk? And they ate chicken with milk. So what should they do? So he said they shouldn't really eat chicken with milk, and if they do, it should be inside, first generation indoors. As far as waiting is concerned, they should wait, but they can wait 1 hour. So all of those young women who say to me, I want to marry a Dutchman so I can wait 1 hour, I'm now going to advise them either a Dutchman or an Ethiopian. Certainly with Rabbi Shalom as his Rav, that's going to be your answer. Interactions with non-Jews, he encouraged them to go further. And let's just to go beyond their previous approach. And let's just finish with a segue into Hanukkah. Look at number 29. He says, should they keep Hanukkah? They never heard of Hanukkah. He says the Beit Yisrael should follow the general Jewish custom today. The entire community has adopted this beautiful custom of Hanukkah. So we observe Hanukkah candles lit in Ethiopian homes as well. The phenomenon proves the distinction that the Ritvaz made between the Ethiopian Jews and the Karaites. In other words, when the Ethiopians return to the land of Israel, they will not object to accepting mitzvot that were handed down already through the mission of the Talmud, and the mitzvah of Hanukkah is a good example of this willingness. And with that, we will segue, because Rabbi Goldschad is here, we will segue into Hanukkah in 3 weeks from now. Please come next week to hear the shiur, even though I'm not here. And Be'ezrat Hashem, we will see you in 3 weeks from now.